Welcome. Well, hello. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
This is the podcast where I usually record an audio feed of my blog, and I wanted to start making it a bit more audible for a podcast listening audience. So the first thing I wanted to do was interview someone who I think is interesting and does work that I think is really important. And I think moderating on Mastodon is definitely a form of that work that qualifies. And I know you do that. And then when I thought about interviewing you, I thought it would also be good to include some basics about this whole free open source software world that we enjoy together. For anyone who listens who doesn't know much about that stuff, because I was recently in that place and it would have been great for me to have this kind of an explainer. So I thought we could start by talking about the basics of free software, Mastodon, Federation, those kind of things, and then talk a little bit about you as a moderator of an instance of Mastodon after that, which I know you recently wrote an article about that was very helpful for me. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks. It was great. I just wrote that article, and it's actually been, it didn't occur to me, but I've been moderating now for 2 years. I joined the team. So it was like, just, time's kind of flying, and I hadn't realized, and it's been a long journey and there's a lot to tell. And so, I felt it was important to write that piece, just the things that I've seen and discussions that I've had. And I realize it's just really a big mystery. And I think it's a really big and important part of, this decentralized, open source sort of ideals, around what social, networks can be and how we can communicate online and, things like that. So I think it's a really important part of it. So I thought, it would be good to put that out there. And yeah, I'd love to talk about that.
Okay, cool. All right, so then let's start with the basic, teaching it to me like I'm five sort of thing for a few things. And I guess we could start with the most all-encompassing or broad topic, which is like free software generally. And I know a lot of people also refer to it as open source software. So do you want to go ahead and try giving your idea of that? I can also define it, but kind of want to get your general take on it first, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's totally fine. And I certainly would defer to you to weigh in on that. But, it's interesting because when OSS, open source software, and free open source software, FOSS, right? The free part of that, it's a little nuanced, but I think it's really important in sort of that culture and how we think about software. And, software is open source, right? The fundamentals are that it means that that source code that's being used, anybody can look at it and see it, and anybody can even modify it and offer suggestions on improvements, things that can be fixed. Someone can say would perform better if it was done this way, or it would be more secure if you did it this way. And the actual owners of that software can approve and say, yeah, that's a great idea. And it's community driven and everyone participates and everyone builds together, rather than having a group of, shareholders or someone somewhere who has control over all this and makes all the decisions for everyone. So it's like, we're making decisions about the software for ourselves rather than having someone make decisions for us. And we're also all contributing and we can see that source code, and it instills a level of trust, which is that other characteristic of open source software. And because you can see the code, exactly what it's doing. And if you're concerned about things like privacy or security or, anything of that nature, you can just take a look for yourself and make a decision on that. And so, that's a sort of, for me, I guess, how I think about the open source software. And when it becomes free, when you add the F in there, that is this whole other angle where software becomes not necessarily a tool for capitalist gain, but it becomes a tool that is for everyone, right? It's like thinking about capitalism versus, socialism or something. I don't know if that's not a perfect analogy, but it's pretty close. And basically saying, once this is free, it means that we're doing this for ourselves because it is going to enrich our lives or make them easier or, make them more fun or exciting or whatever the case might be. And we pay for it through our time and work together rather than paying for it, with with our bank account, you know, like a community garden, right, you know, type of thing.
Yes, right? Yes. And I kind of figured other people might not always give the same strict definition that I would give if asked about it. And that's sort of what I wanted by asking you first about defining it, because in general, I kind of wanted to hear your general connotations and thoughts about it, feelings about it, because a lot of things are, you know, powerful in that they have a general impression or sort of general associations with us. And I know you know a lot more about free open source software, open source stuff in general than plenty of other people, but we've talked before a little bit about free software. And I remember getting the sense that you were lucky, I think, in not getting too tangled up in the weeds of some of the more semantic arguments and debates that happened at certain times within the free software community. And I guess maybe it's a good time to speak to those really quickly, because I think it's kind of interesting from what I gathered as I went from being someone who used, you know, whatever was out there to being someone a bit more strict about it and wanting to use software with particular types of licenses and things. And that was all, it was all kind of interesting. So I guess I think you're right in pointing out the parallel between a more socialist economic model and the free open source software model, because like you said, it is like a community owned project. And at first I thought that the difference between free software and free open source, or just open source software, was actually something of a controversy between different camps within the free software community. And it kind of bugged me. I was sort of puzzled about it for a long time. Like, wait, okay, there's people who say open source and they use that as, you know, a synonym for free software. And then there's the Free Software Foundation, which has this very specific definition for free software. And they even say things like, it's not the same as open source, right? And that was always interesting at first. And that's kind of, that's like where I started. So I started out from that perspective. And of course, the definition of free software is very specific. If you go from there, that definition includes these four freedoms: to access code, to definitely be able to view it, but also be able to edit it, make changes to it, to distribute it, and to distribute your changes to it, and to use it for whatever you want. So in defining these four freedoms really specifically, the free software movement was seeking to make sure strategically that like no attempts to commodify any piece of software with this type of license could be out of the free zone as well, right? So you'll hear free software folks saying like, oh yeah, it might be a commercial software, but it will also always be free. Like you can sell it, like, you know, you can sell a hug for $1 or whatever, but right, you can also give out free hugs, right?
Right.
You can never stop a free software from being a free software, even if, you know, you can take a copy of it and decide that's going to be some special copy that you're going to sell or whatever. It's actually still legally at bottom going to be free, and not just free of cost, but freedom creating for the users and for everyone. So people can be both users of it and developers of it, make copies of it. And that's the kind of formal definition. And then when I started noticing this weird divide, I thought, okay, why is this happening? And at first it seemed like the open source phrasing was kind of a marketing term, and I saw it as kind of coming more from the European branch of the free software community. Like that kind of felt like an association, you know, as your brain's trying to piece together stuff. And then I looked into it a little bit more, and indeed, like the Free Software Foundation Europe does specifically say things like open source is the same as free software. And I noticed then that some of the people who really minded that and really wanted to push for the free terminology instead were saying, if you just say open source, then you're not actually speaking to all four of these freedoms, which are important strategically in a legal sense, right? But then after years of this, I kind of started thinking about it more. And I think what's actually happening is that the European style, let's say, the more open source leaning framing of this, I think what they actually intended was to use open source as a synonym in order that companies who use open as a branding term, as a marketing term, would also be held to the same legal standard as free open source software. It took me a while, but I think I'm correct about this. I really believe this. And I've talked to some people who are on the European side of things or who say the open source sort of thing. And that is really, I think, what they mean. Like, I think that the Free Software Foundation Europe president and people on the board there are indeed hoping that by insisting on this relationship between these terms, that companies won't be able to quote unquote open wash their products because they will also be held to the same legal standard as the free software. Yeah, that's, I think, what's happening at least. So, yeah.
Well, it's, as I was listening to you talk through that, I think there are a couple of things that stood out to me. One, I think there is a clear distinction. It seems really nuanced, you know, adding the free to that. But I think there's an important part of that, that being a distinction that just open source software, one, yes, I think people abuse that term a little bit for like marketing type reasons or to sort of say...
Because if you do make your, let's say you make your source code visible
right.
to the public,
right.
but you do not, but it is not... under a free open source software license, if it's not under a license that actually stipulates that it can be used, changed, reproduced, and distributed in
right.
these ways, yeah,
right.
like freely like this, then that would be open washing, right? Your people have this association with the idea of open source from its history as being a more progressive style of developing software.
Right.
And so companies will maybe use that term and then make their software source code available for viewing, let's say, but it's not licensed under a free software license, and then therefore, okay, people think it's open source because they can see the source code, but that doesn't mean they're legally permitted to use it any way they want, change
yeah.
it, distribute it. Yeah,
I think so. A couple of things. One, and I think that's when we, if you want to go back to the basics, talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old kind
right,
of thing
right.
here. I think what you and I didn't touch on right now is that there's this element to, and I want to say, I just wanted to say open source, but if we're getting
yeah,
to
go
the
for
nuanced
it. No, no.
definitions,
yeah.
when you have software that's like licensed, like, you know, if it's FOSS software
right.
free, you can do something which is called forking. And a lot of people aren't going to
yes.
know what that is unless they're technical. But what that means is it basically says there's this code base and it's being used under these, you know, in this environment and all this stuff. If you fork that, what that means is that basically means that you duplicate it and you now have your own version of that. And you are bound by the original free and open source software license of that, which means what I can do is I can modify it. I can change it around. I can use it for a different purpose. And then I can release it under the, you know, within the environment that I want for the purposes that I want that kind of all fit within that. And you can even take lots of different little mini FOSS repos and put them together and compile this completely new piece of free and open source software that comprises all these other, you know, little bits and pieces that other people have developed. And that part of it is what makes it this modifiable, changeable, like, you know, infinite running sort of, there's this concept of, I think they call it forever soup. I don't remember where you add things to it and then you pull it out and you bake it. I mean, you cook it and you add things to it and you eat some of it and then you put it back in the fridge and then you add more and you cook it. It's like,
I mean,
never
this
ending.
Is, sounds disgusting and dangerous, but I know
really
what you mean.
Does.
I know what you mean.
It really does.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good analogy, actually, in a way, but it also doesn't make it sound very appetizing. But no, you're right.
No.
It
no,
is that, it
no.
is this licensing. It's actually the intellectual property laws that are specified when a piece of code is published
right.
that make it possible legally for people to do this without any legal repercussions to go ahead and take it, make it, and actually sell it. It is okay to sell free software.
Okay. If it's just open source software, what you're saying is this is a capitalist venture, but I want to be transparent about
yes,
the code
exactly.
that I'm using. So it's just about transparency, and that's what the open source means. And when you move to FOSS,
right.
free and open source software, then what you have is you have something that anybody can use and anybody can modify and all that stuff. And that's the major difference. It's about transparency versus it actually is a community-driven project that anyone can use and contribute
right.
to. So I think that's probably the key.
I think
factor.
That's, yeah, I think that's what's happening. And I think it's kind of sad in a way what happened culturally speaking, in a sense, with the free software movement, because when the open source term started getting popular, I think when sort of FSFE and some others were like, oh, let's make open source require these legal freedoms, I think what happened was the free software community in the United States, or at least the FSF in the US, saw that and thought that in Europe they were trying to water down the definition and lighten up on the restrictions and make transparency the only necessary factor. And that's, I don't think that's what they were trying to do. I think there was a misunderstanding there. And I think that what happened was that in the United States, the free software community, a lot of them, at least this side of it, basically fought back really hard against that terminology and suggested that this was a watering down. And because of that, there was like division in the community instead of working together and saying like, oh yeah, we're going to require that anything called open source have these four freedoms, which would have been empowering to the movement. And it would have totally been a great thing. And instead we have this whole confusion. People don't really know. There's sort of two different branches. But I think that we are at least aware of these distinctions. And I hope talking about them is helpful to other people.
Yeah.
I think it would have been to me if I had heard this a few years ago.
Well, it's complicated and there's a lot of layers. And I mean, I'm learning things as we're talking right now. So it's complicated.
Right. And that's probably because I'm definitely going to pull things in the direction of any information I might have to share. So I appreciate if I can share any of the little pieces of info that I might have. But I definitely learned a lot from you when I read your article, for example, about moderation. So maybe we can move on from this part quickly. But let's say that was a little bit of a detour into free software versus open source. But let's say I think we can use those interchangeably. I think we should push for open source as being defined by the four freedoms. I think that would be great if it could happen, even if late. I'm happy using them synonymously if you are.
It's easier in conversation. So yes, that makes sense. Perfectly.
Right. It's already used that way. And I think it would be great if the actual intention there were to happen, right? For instance, there's these groups like the Open Source Initiative, the OSI, which I think was established as an attempt to insist on, you know, strict legal definition for the use of a term like open source, okay? So it would be great if that initiative could function in the way that I think the open source branding was initially intended, I think, to kind of enforce these four freedoms. So let's say open source, free software, the same thing in our minds now, and we've talked about the differences and why there's confusion there. But yes, there are intellectual property laws, thankfully, because the Free Software Foundation and the GNU project started back at the dawn of personal computing in the 80s, and a few very smart people were like, okay, wait, computers are becoming a big thing. These are going to be huge. People should be allowed to like hack things and use whatever they can. You know, there shouldn't be these ridiculous barriers to doing basic things with computers just because somebody profits off of forcing you to use their brand, right?
Right.
And they said, well, we're going to need to create intellectual property laws and frameworks to ensure that this is possible, because this is all new technology. You know, no one's used this stuff before. We have to write the laws if we want them to be there. No one who's making a profit off this stuff is going to write these laws.
Yeah.
So, right? So those original little angels made
their
made
foresight.
This all possible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, yeah.
Monumental. It's just, you know, we should be very grateful that they had that foresight and took the time to take some of those ideas and put them into action, because, you know, we may have without that reach a point of no return and found, you know, the internet to be a really horrible place of, you know, just nothing but capitalism in a way that, like, you know,
we can't even imagine. Exactly. Like, we think it's bad now, but like people
still
have so many freedoms because of this area of law. I'm
agreed.
Eternally grateful.
Yeah, agreed.
Social media, you know, a lot of people use Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, which I still call Twitter because fuck you, Elon Musk.
Not ever. It's a rebellious thing, right? Like, I am explicitly not calling it X because fuck you, Elon. Just no. Yes, sorry.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
I feel similarly. I just want to disrespect Elon Musk as clearly as possible.
Yes.
Probably some of the developers were probably pretty cool, but they've probably been fired because if they were cool, they probably pushed back against shitifying the product. They were
got axed, as a result.
Anyway, but we are in the Fediverse, you and I, and let's see. Let's talk about the Fediverse first, and then Mastodon, and then Instances, and then Federation, I guess.
Okay.
We'll try to get through it if we have time.
Sure.
Fediverse, you are going to be better at describing. I know that it's a bunch of interconnected networks that are all interoperable because they're built on the ActivityPub protocol. So for non-techie people, I mean, even for me, I just think of a protocol as like a sort of general set of principles for how certain information is received and requested and exchanged over the internet. So like with email, there are common protocols that make it possible to send emails to people and receive emails from people, even if you're both using different email providers. Either way, you can still send emails and receive emails because of this common protocol. So the Fediverse, I know, is similar in that way. Would you say that's a good explanation? Is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think you definitely got it right. I think a good way to think about it, and especially when you're thinking about, you know, social networks and that kind of thing, if you think about it in big social traditional terms, if you have a Facebook account and someone on Twitter posts something, you can't see it in your Facebook feed or reply to it or anything. Those two things are walled off from each other. Within the Fediverse, you can be on Mastodon and someone can have a PixelFed account or a PeerTube account. These are platforms within the Fediverse. And if you follow them and if those two servers know about each other, then you can communicate and do the things you need to do. Even though you're on a different platform, you can communicate with people on that other platform because they share that protocol. And the email protocol is like the best, most classic way to really describe that, where, you know, email is such that, like you said, you can be on any email platform using any email client or provider or anything else. And when someone sends you an email, you can see it, read it, reply to it, forward it to anybody else who has an email client, and they can do the same. And that's because they all send, the protocol being in essence the type of data and how it's relayed so that your software can read it. And so it just basically means that the data is structured and it's all formatted in a certain way that those two different platforms, even though they function different and have their own wildly different features and everything else, can read the fundamental core data and metadata that's underneath that, and then be able to relay data back and forth between those platforms. The Fediverse is like email, essentially, that data can go between those different platforms, but at a more complex level, because the platforms that are on the Fediverse are wildly different from one another.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think that's helpful. Okay, Mastodon is one social media platform within the Fediverse.
Correct.
Mastodon, as I understand, was built to mimic or serve as an alternative for Twitter, in that there's these, you know, microblogging posts that can be boosted, as we say, and that's kind of like a retweet from Twitter, and they can be favorited. I guess Twitter had like hearts or something, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's kind of Mastodon. And then I think the decentralization part is what a lot of people get confused about, and sort of the instances aspect. So let's talk about that. So like when you first get on Mastodon, a lot of people just stop there and don't do it because they're confused because they need to pick a server.
Yes.
I understand that that is part of what makes it federated, in the sense that we use federated as a term to refer to the interconnectivity between the different instances.
Right.
And so that's sort of dependent on this shared protocol, but also dependent on it being free software, in the sense that you can be anybody and you can run an instance if you have the time and the computing power, energy, you know, whatever to do that. You can legally fire up an instance and be the moderator or be the sysadmin and decide on what code of conduct you're going to have on your instance. Therefore, this decentralization aspect to it is tied in with it being free software, but they are separate, right? You can have free software that isn't decentralized, but it's decentralized thanks to the fact that it's free software and that it's built on this shared protocol, right? So let's see. Usually it's probably like a little team of people who work together to run an instance, right? Because you have to have servers, you have to have computers. Even if it's like a little Raspberry Pi or something, it has to be dedicated to staying online, staying connected to power,
right?
And running the software,
right?
Continuously and updating. You have to update it, I'm sure.
Yep.
So, and then, you know, when there's variations on a software, even the original software, probably that Mastodon.social is running, the most updated version probably is also still potentially a few bugs in there that need to be addressed every once in a while.
Always worked
on, right? So let alone other people's forks, where they'll make it a little bit different maybe. Or if they're just running whatever the updated version is, they might still need to work on things with their particular machine, you know, that, right? It's going to like depend on which machine you're running, you know? So I think I've explained that fine. Although last time I talked to you about this, you did a little bit of explanation of federation and how a user connects with different users, the way that kind of plays out.
Yeah.
If you're on an instance like Mastodon.social, which is the biggest, has the most users, how that works versus like being on a tiny server that you ran. I should also clarify that server and instance here are interchangeable. So when I say an individual server, I'm also talking about an individual instance, a running instance of Mastodon, the software.
And those are 100% interchangeable. There is literally no difference. It's just a different way to describe it. So I think that's really important to note.
Right, right. And I mean, there can be servers for different things that aren't Mastodon. But in the case when we're talking about Mastodon and we talk about a server, we're talking about an instance of Mastodon.
Right.
A particular instance. So, and it might mean many different computers, but if they're running the same instance, if they're hosting content that is all located at the same address, then that's one instance. That we're talking about.
Right. Yes. I mean, so it's like the idea of decentralization is a blessing and a curse in that it's worth the trouble. Just, you know, it's paramount to note that it's worth all of the complications, because what decentralized means is that no one has the master key to this social network, you know, that we call Mastodon. Yes, there is an organization that holds the core license and the core repo source code, but it belongs to everyone and everyone can use it. And like you said, anyone can fire up an instance. And sometimes it's a handful of people, sometimes it's one person, and you can install the software and host it yourself from the closet in your house if you want. Mm-hmm. And that's totally fine. And that means all the data that's there belongs to you. And I could spend like 2 hours trying to explain all of the benefits and all of the nooks and crannies of this. But
I know, that's why I'm like, we should make some, I think we should continue in the future if we have time. I'll certainly try to, and it will be great if I can have you as well.
I would love that. And I think there's a good benefit to it. I think fundamentally, like if we want to break it down into the most important elements, what a centralized social network like Facebook or Twitter, if you fire up Facebook, everybody who's using Facebook is using the same version of Facebook. It's the same thing. And it's on a collection of servers, right, that are all mirrored and everything else that Facebook owns and they have control over. And they can say, you don't belong here and you're out and you don't get to be here anymore. Or they can write their own bylaws and rules about moderation and things like that. And they just get to make these decisions. And if those decisions aren't made in the interest of the people using the software, those decisions are made in the interest of the people who are going to earn money from the software. And as most people who would be listening to this are aware, there's that whole concept, you know, you are the data, you are, you know, essentially.
Oh, right,
the
right.
Money.
I've heard this. If you're not paying for the product, you are the product.
Yes, you are the product. And that's the thing. And so you're paying for it, right? Because social networks have been free, that, you know, universally, that's just been the model since the beginning, basically.
Well, they're free of cost often because I think that kind of became obvious as necessary to accomplish like the network effect, right? To get a bunch of people onto it, you want to reduce all the barriers to entry, right?
Right.
So
and from
once you've got all the people, right, then they monetize, then they make money other ways, right? With ads.
So how do we make money other ways, right? Like advertisements and whatever. And so they wind up selling data and there's all this privacy, you know, it's a total fucking nightmare. But like, so what happens with decentralized social network, it means that everybody's has their own, right, in what we call an instance of Mastodon that they're running, and all of the Mastodon instances talk to each other the same way that, you know, like that mirrored servers in a Facebook data farm would talk to each other. The difference being that everybody is running their own. Now, when I say everybody's running their own, there's that connection that, like, when you're talking about something like Facebook or Twitter, all of the, when you sign up an account, it's centralized into this one central, you know, network or database of information. And so everyone that's on Twitter talks to each other because they're all there and they all know about each other because Twitter is one thing that knows
right?
It's like this omnipresent, like as an analogy, God, right? That like it's all knowing of everyone who uses Twitter. The thing about Mastodon and being decentralized, it means that if I decide to take my Raspberry Pi here and install Mastodon on it, give it a domain, fire it up, launch it to the world, it exists. But not every Mastodon instance that's out there in the world knows that my Mastodon instance exists. It doesn't happen automatically because it is my own piece of software that I am publishing to the world. And the only way that my software can then connect to the other software is essentially by those instances and my instance beginning to communicate together. So
through their users, right?
Like through the users. And yeah. The Mastodon software itself taps into sort of like a default, you know, list of ones that are larger and more known about. It feeds those in. So when you fire up a Mastodon instance, you're not like, hello, anybody there, you know, tapping on the mic and there's like no one that exists. That would be a really weird thing. So they do feed a few things in there. And once you see that, then you're like, oh, this is a bunch of data that's coming in and now I can start talking to people. So what happens is if I fire up my instance and you fire up your instance, we both have installed our own Mastodon and we launch it to the world, we don't actually know each other exists. But the moment that you tell me and we're on a phone call and you're like, hey, I'm on Mastodon and this is my Mastodon instance, and I search for you and I find you, once I find you and I follow you and maybe you follow me back, now our two instances know about each other. And that means that now when I publish things, you'll see them. When you publish things, I'll see them. And again, there's myriad granularities to this, but just at the fundamental level, this is what's happening. And now all of the other instances that I communicate with, suddenly you now have a connection to all of those instances
through me.
And so it's an exponential growth of connectivity. And once all the instances start communicating and talking to each other, then they know about the other ones. And that's what makes it become this network. But it's still decentralized because even though all of these servers are communicating together, they're still run by the own individual people. And I can at any point in time just decide, I don't want to do this anymore. And I can pull the plug on my instance and I'm just gone. But all of the rest of Mastodon is still there doing its thing. And that means that there's no one entity, corporation, right. A billionaire, an oligarch, someone who says right. Mastodon can't exist anymore and pull the plug on all of Mastodon. That literally cannot be done because right. we're all in control and we all have our own versions and we just keep communicating together and it's empowering and it's literally, it's just all the people working together creating this network of community, right? So
right. It's genuinely bottom up in that way. Yeah, no, and I want to say that it's the intellectual property that we talked about at the beginning is like fundamental to this because, mm-hmm. right, it's like how, you know, you might memorize a song or something and maybe it would be illegal for you to publish that song as your own, right? But with free software, with something like Mastodon, it's published in a way that indicates everyone has the legal right to publish it as their own because it is yes. their own instance of it. So for that reason, it's always legal to run your own instance, and therefore people run their own instances, right? And even if like all of the existing instances were to go down, it would still be possible to run it again. Of course, these things are more powerful or more influential or more helpful or whatever when more people use them. That's what makes them what they are, right? You don't really want to go on a social network where no one's there. That's why it would be great if everyone I know would just start using Mastodon instead of Facebook and Twitter. Yes. But, you know, there has been this confusion about these things. I think there's a lot of messaging that things should be easy and that this is too hard, that just choosing a server, if it's at all difficult, you know, why should you put up with that when you can go through something where it just kind of guides you through clicks to the end till you're set up and yep. you're going. And, yep. you know, and I understand that completely. Of course, that's lovely, but the costs are real. You're yes. giving up the right to your data. Most of the time, you're giving up the right to your friendships, your social networks, because, you know, you can't communicate with those people without that, which, you know, it's still true for me. Like, I don't talk to certain people that I used to talk to because I don't use Instagram anymore. And that right. is like a sacrifice, right? But at the same time, I was exhausted always trying to convince people to adopt free software when I was there. And I didn't know when that would ever end. And I just couldn't keep using it when it just felt like morally repugnant to me because I knew that I was working for free to support this tech monopoly, essentially. I mean, participation on those platforms is actively contributing to the value, the financial value of those products. So there's this kind of moral side to it. And I know a lot of people are like, well, you know, I don't really have the option. People at work do this and that. And I appreciate that. And I wish you know, there were better solutions to these things, because I definitely don't expect everyone to have the same ability to just change everything in their life into, you know, using other tools and things and care as much about it as maybe I did. I kind of became obsessed with it for a little while, and I tend to have these special interests, you know, as they say, these focus areas that really consume my attention for long periods of time.
Yep.
So this happened to be one of them. So I don't expect that to be the case for everybody or for most people. But I do want to just say that there are costs to using the things that are the most seemingly convenient. And a lot of people, more people than I think some realize, are very much against using those non-free software platforms and have switched and are using things in the Fediverse and are using free open source stuff, free open hardware, because of all of these larger implications and political effects. And I just want to say, like, there's those people, you know, like a lot of progressive movements are unfortunately stuck on those non-free platforms.
So much. Yeah.
You know, and it's tough to see, because there are a lot of really cool progressive people in the Fediverse who do not use those things, will not use those things. And
yeah.
For good reason, right? And it's weird.
I'm
it's
one
sad.
Of them. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. And it's sad seeing this misunderstanding between people, where people might think I'm inflexible, like I'm this jerk who,
right.
You know, who won't even use an app for political work. And it's like, well, no, the fact that we're abiding by this is part of our political situation. It's a really important part of our political situation. There are alternatives. If there weren't any alternatives, I would feel differently. But given the breadth of alternatives, right? And I mean, maybe I'm underestimating my, I don't know, intellect or something, but like, given the fact that even I could adopt them, it makes me feel like it's worth a lot more interest, public interest, and it's really just lack of awareness that I think causes this divide and this confusion, because the options, once you get into them and get used to them, are liberating in so many ways. And then your means are aligned with your ends, you know, then you're already on communications infrastructure that can support you, even if a monopolist oligarch decided to abide by some BS fascist government attempt to spy on users, or, you know, even curb political speech or what have you, right?
Right.
Okay, Mastodon, we've kind of explained it pretty well, I think. We've talked about servers and instances. We've talked about decentralization. And so, okay, we barely have any time left. Do you think we could talk for another 15 minutes?
Let's do it.
Okay. So in that, we'll try to do a speed run through moderation. You've written a great article about it. I'll just start off by saying that social media, Instagram, and all those as well, have moderators. They have people working to look at reported content and deal with it, right? How do we protect users from a bunch of junk, right? Spam,
right.
Ads, harmful stuff, violent stuff, hate speech, the darkest stuff on the internet, right? That stuff can flood these sites if there weren't dedicated moderators. And so what you do is generous, because you're volunteering your time. You know, this isn't like a paid gig for like a big tech company, right? Right. You're sitting there sifting through the worst stuff on the internet, stuff you don't want to have to see, and you're not being paid, but you're doing it out of the kindness of your heart to make the experience on that platform tolerable and nice for people. And that's awesome. And it means a lot to me personally. I really appreciate your work. So I just want to give you another opportunity, maybe through this Audible medium, to share this interesting information from the perspective of someone doing that work, if you want to just go for it.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So thank you. I appreciate your kind words. You know, all the moderators, yeah, we're volunteering and all this stuff, but it's just, it's in alignment with, you know, with free and open source software, right? Like, it's, we build this together. Once we build it together, then we've got to manage it together, you know? So it's like, somebody's got to do this. And there are positive and negative things, you know, to being a moderator. And the positive stuff, the good stuff, is very rewarding in a way that, you know, makes the negative stuff, the harmful stuff, worthwhile.
Tolerable, I guess. Yeah, yeah. Worthwhile. Right.
I mean, it's interesting because I was part of the mass Twitter exodus, for those who don't know, when Elon took over Twitter, this mass exodus, everybody left and everybody seemed to go right to Mastodon. You know, thousands, tens of thousands, literally, of people just migrated over to Mastodon. And that was in the fall of 22. I was one of those people. people. I was like, I am out. There's no way. And so we arrived here and I was here for, I think it was a couple months. And I had reached out to, like, almost right away. I was like, this is amazing. This is the coolest fucking idea for a social network. Like, just, you know, I didn't really know anything. I'd heard about Mastodon and I'd heard about decentralized social networks. I didn't know anything about it. And I was like, you know, but this is the time for me to figure it out. So I went and I created an account, posted a couple things. I engaged with 10 times as many or more people on Mastodon within the first week that I was there, compared with like my 3 or 4 years or however long I'd been on Twitter. And I was like, this is amazing. This is like people were communicating. And I realized it's because not everything's driven by an algorithm. Like, I'm not popular like on Twitter right at the time. So nobody saw anything that I tweeted and I couldn't find other people. I show up on Mastodon and it's a level playing field and everybody's just there. And I'm like, this is amazing. The timeline is literally a timeline. It's in sequential order and like I can filter it and whatever. Anyways, so I was like, this is amazing. And then I saw something on there about moderation or whatever. And I was like, yes, I can do that. I can be that. And so I reached out to our admin, Trumpet is his handle. And I was like, dude, I don't know if you need moderators or I don't know how this works and I've never done this, but if you ever need help with that, please let me know because I would love to do it. So he says, yeah, let's, you know, I've been thinking about it and there's this, you know, influx of people, we're growing. I don't know how I'm going to be able to manage this. So yes, I'll probably reach out to you. I'm making a list. Like 2 months later, he reaches out and he's like, okay, I'm ready. This is insane. There's so many people here and help. And I was like, yes. And so he brought me and another woman on and the two of us, and there were a couple other moderators. They're now gone, but we hopped on and that was it. And I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't know what to do and all this other stuff. I mean, it was all, I had no business being a moderator really on paper, right? But I knew that I cared and I knew that I fucking hate fascists and racists and bigots and misogynists. And I was like, you know, being a moderator means I can help curb those people's time, you know?
Right. It's like a nonviolent way of enforcing a code of conduct that agrees with your social values. So you're like, yeah, no, of course. All you need is to care and to want to learn and to learn how to do it. And that's it. And then, so you and the team, people who were more experienced there, like kind of showed you the ropes a little bit.
Yeah.
But essentially, what's the job like? I mean, basic steps kind of thing.
Yeah. So we're learning all the time and growing all the time. We have a chat group that we're in and we're discussing everything together all the time and kind of learning it. Just because it seems like on paper, like, okay, you got rules, you break the rule and, you know, you're gone.
Right. But it's like the law, right? I mean, it's, you need courts and juries and time.
So, you know, the basic idea is, you know, someone sees something questionable and they report it. It shows up in our queue. We look at it and then we make a decision to either ignore it, like, nah, that's not a problem, it's cool. And we do something called resolving, which is just dismissing it and saying it's cool, whatever.
Right.
Or we moderate it, which is taking an action. And there are these different actions. You can delete posts. You can force posts to be marked as sensitive, meaning that like some servers allow explicit material, you know, and like every instance has their own rules about that. On our instance, the administrator has decided that it's okay, like nudity is okay, if it's marked as sensitive. What that means is Mastodon has a setting so that like if you're scrolling your feed and some pornographic type material go by, they're blurred out and you won't see them. And that's like, that's your marked as sensitive. You can change your settings so that that is in your feed, you'll see it and you don't want it to be blurred and everything is fine. But we can force people to do that. If they don't follow the rule and blur their stuff, mark it as sensitive, then we can mark it for them and we can force all of their posts to be marked that way, right? That's just action.
Okay.
So we can do that, or we can suspend an account, which is a complete nuke. You're gone. Nobody on our server will ever know of your existence again. Your material is deleted. Full, you know, banishment. And then there's things like you can limit an account, which means that they will only be seen by people who already follow them, that they can't just, you know, so they won't show up in feeds and things. You can, you know, just warn someone. You can say, somebody reported this, we think it's a little sketch or whatever, or maybe we would like you to behave a little bit differently in this way. So we're warning you and saying, please don't do this type of thing in the future, you know, whatever. So you take all these actions. So they come in, the queue, we see them. We decide to just resolve them or we moderate them. And that's pretty much the scope of it.
Okay, you're right. And then I read in your article something about not being able to moderate your own content, kind of certain controls like that, that kind of keep everybody at the same level, right?
And that's a rule of thumb, right? Like, that's not even like a Mastodon, you know, sort of reporting thing. We just decide as a group, we say, you know, for integrity, to make sure that we are acting and thinking about and moderating objectively, we want to be able to gut check each other. Because sometimes, you know, we make bad calls. And so, yeah, so like if somebody reports me, then I'm not allowed to moderate or dismiss that. Also, and I forgot about the last part of the steps. If we moderate someone, if we make a moderatable decision and we say I'm deleting a post or suspending or whatever, someone can appeal that. And what that means is that they see that they've been had a post deleted and they can appeal and say, I want to plea my case. This is why I think that that moderation was inappropriate. And we can decide to accept that appeal, which means it reverses it, or we reject it and say, nah, this, you're wrong. So if one of us has moderated something, we don't respond to the appeal. We let someone else from our team respond to the appeal. So that, again, so that like, okay, I made a decision. Was that the right decision, teammate? And sometimes we argue about it. Sometimes we agree to disagree on some things. And there are some topics that are really hot that we have a really, really hard time working through. But we try to make it objective through those honest conversations. We've even, I think, made each other angry on a couple of occasions. And, you know, it's been not pretty. Yeah. We take a deep breath, take a break, and get back to it and know that we're on the same team. Yeah. But it takes a lot of work to be really objective and to make sure we're doing the right thing as much as possible.
Right. I mean, that's a problem with the law in general, I feel like, right? So that's like, you know, you're at the forefront there. You're at the bleeding edge of social organization, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
so that's awesome. I mean, I understand it's difficult. It certainly sounds, you know, effortful, time consuming and that. But it's really nice to think that there are people who are looking at a situation as a human being, right? And making decisions as a human being, right? That it's not just sort of like some program that's looking at some predetermined sentence structure or keywords or whatever and just kind of like doing that sort of a thing. And
yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's nice to think that that's how moderation or any kind of social, let's say, restraint or I want to say like policy making and enforcement works. So that's nice to hear. And you had mentioned before that there's sort of like the good things and the bad things about it. And I guess I know obviously it's going to be difficult sometimes to put in a lot of work with something. But in your article, I remember reading that, you know, one of the good things about it is just the feeling that you're able to, like you said, kind of fight fascism a little bit, right? Like push back against hate speech, against violence, against things that just are not in line with humanism and compassion and tolerance for people. So that's a worthwhile thing. I can imagine gathering some or gaining some gratification from that. And then I know I read about some of the bad times that you've had. And I know some of that is just seeing things that are traumatizing and needing even to process that stuff with a counselor and stuff. And that's understandable. And then there's been even times where people have retaliated against moderation and gone after you as an individual, right? Like figuring out who moderated them and then looking into you and trying to find some way to hurt you back. And I mean, I'll put a link to the article in the podcast notes, but I can understand that being pretty horrible. I don't know if you want to talk about that experience or if you just want to close with notes about how you deal with that or how you continue on. I don't know. Maybe I should just say thank you for the work you put in. It means a lot to me.
No, well, thank you. I can touch on it briefly. I mean, you know, I've been an activist for almost my entire life. You know, I was a young teenager, really rebellious, and got into all of this activism and animal rights stuff. And, you know, I started, you know, protesting then. I went to my first protest when I was a teenager. And, you know, I've been doing that. I've been on the streets protesting and being very active on the front lines, again, for decades. And it's just a core part of my life and who I am. And I've integrated that into my career as a designer, as a developer, as a writer, as a public lecturer. All of those things, everything that I talk about is based on those values that I have as an activist on inclusivity and just making the world a better place wherever I can. And so moderation is just an extension of that, you know, and it's a way to be empowered, you know, in a different way. And yeah, there's just, there is, I mean, there's just a lot of trauma, like in being a moderator. And I don't, you know, I don't know. I mean, some people that could come across, I suppose, as just being, you know, thin skinned or weak or, you know, I'm sure people, you know, whatever. But I don't, honestly, I don't really care if that's the way it looks because it is, it's traumatic. There's, I've just seen things and like things that people have said and images and other stuff that are horrifying. And, you know, they're just, it's horrifying to see them alone just as is, right, at face value. But it's also, it invokes a lot of reflection on just being human and all of these other things and realizing what human beings are capable of, you know.
Right, and seeing the worst case scenarios, like things that, that when there's something that is depicted or referred to that you know actually happens at times.
Yes.
You know, you're responding to that representation of it the way you might respond to seeing it or, you know, witnessing what it's referring to. And so I think that's very human. Like anyone who's so desensitized to that, they're either not thinking about the reality of it, or I feel sorry for them because they're seeing the reality so often that they're used to it and they've had to come up with ways to cope with that. So,
or they are, you know, I think, what do they call it? Is I think there's like a literal medical mental condition where brains aren't able to process trauma that way, where they don't feel like those emotions or empathy and stuff. And
that is sad, right? Because that is disconnect, you know, from other people. So so I mean, I just appreciate very much that you're appreciating the seriousness and the reality of things that might just be referred to in a post and might indeed indicate genuine intent to harm or something else, right? So
that's the way
I would hope moderators would see things, you know.
Yeah. You know, you have to try to detach a little bit, but honestly, I can't. I don't know how. People have their methods, you know, I suppose, for shielding against that stuff. And I certainly have some that I try to and whatever, but it doesn't. I mean, if you're a person and you have any sort of empathy for people, you can't see and read those things and not feel something.
In psychology, there's like empathic distress, which is kind of where you're like overwhelmed by the emotion that might be catching on you. Or, you know, there's cognitive empathy, which I think you're having, right? Where you are aware of what you would feel. And therefore you're reacting to it the way you would hope someone reacts to it to protect someone else from it. Because at the end of the day, as a moderator, you're doing the job of protecting the weakest people, the people who are the most vulnerable, the people who would be harmed, right?
The most targeted. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's really, great. I think it's really great that you're able to take things that way. And that's the way I would hope moderators would see things. So, and I'm glad also that you have some strategies for just generally keeping yourself a little bit protected from it, but at the same time, recognizing the seriousness, you know?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's hard. And I don't, you know, I'm
right. It's not easy.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to like, you know, I don't, when I say that too, I don't mean to position that from like, I'm a hero and here's fucking why, you know, it's not, I'm just saying it is, that's just the nature of it. I would be remiss not to talk about moderation and not mention the fact that there are traumatic elements of being a moderator, right? It's just matter of fact, it just is what it is. But I think it balances out because again, you know, we touched on it, having the power as you know, I've been an activist my whole life, protester, all the things I live my life in this way, and this gives me an element of power in places that I don't normally have them, you know, and watching these fascists run around and do horrible things, it sucks. A lot of people, anybody with a heart feels really helpless about all this stuff. It feels overwhelming. It feels just all the things, right? You feel all the things. Right. As a moderator, I have a benefit of being able to not just feel helpless, but I can actually take an action that says, here's a horrible person and I'm removing them. And it's, you know, all I'm doing is saying they can't communicate with other people on this like social
network. But we know today how much harm is done through that medium.
Yes.
So it means a lot. It means a lot. I mean, I spend most of my social time is virtual. So, makes a big difference to me, you know. Yeah.
It matters. It's just, it's important and it feels, you know, when you see some shit like that, you see some really horrible things or that someone has said or images or whatever, and you push that, you know, if I click or tap on that button that says suspend or delete post, it just fills me up with just such satisfaction, you know? And I'm diagnosed ADHD, and one of the things that I struggle with a lot is something called justice sensitivity. And that means when justice is not served, it causes me literal emotional distress. And that makes all of the injustices in the world combined, very, very problematic for someone like me. It causes me a lot of physical strain. And this gives me one way to combat that, where I'm saying, justice is fucking served. I'm suspending you, you know? And that is like, I can't put into words. It's indescribable how empowering it is to be able to do that. So like that reward alone, like makes everything else worthwhile, you know, just being able to do that. Know that like of all the people who are marginalized and targeted and all the stuff, here's one way where I have some control and I'm able to help them in some way. Yeah. And that makes me feel so good.
Yeah. Awesome. That makes me want to be a moderator. I mean, that sounds, that sounds great. No, really, right? Yeah. I mean, it does.
Yeah.
And it's, it's like a person like you. It's nice to know you, and it's nice to know that there are other people like you who are doing this. It's just nice. I feel that way in general about, like you said, everyone in the free software community working on things and building things that I like to use and get to use, knowing how they're made and everything. It's similar with this. So now I want to go be a moderator as well. So thank you. Thank you. I know I guess we've gone way over time. So I hope we can talk again sometime soon about more of these topics. And in general, I recommend people read your article, which I'll link to, because there are some things in there that we didn't get to. And I think it's well written and I liked it. So for those who are interested, it'll be there.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Rachel. I'm so glad. I mean, you know, we're friends. We talk a lot. And this, I'm glad you invited me, and I'm honored that you wanted to have me talk with you about this, because I think it's really cool and you're a great person and have a lot of knowledge. So I appreciate our conversations, and this has been really awesome. So thank you.
Same. Well, thank you again. Okay. Well, yeah, I'll talk to you again soon then, and hopefully on the podcast.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome. Welcome. Welcome.